where it's been on nationalistic lines. If you were British in Australia, you were generally a coalition thing, and if you were Irish, you were generally in the Labour Party, and Australia didn't represent what sort of work you'd done or what you didn't do. If you were British, you generally favoured what they called imperial preference, and you voted united and country and liberal and country. And if you were Labour, you were generally a Catholic. Of course, that was the only left-wing party the Catholic Church ever supported.
I didn't know this. I mean, I'm learning off you now. You know, I don't really know much about Australian politics.
But that was basically true. Of course, in Victoria, when I threw what they call commies come on, Archbishop Mannix formed the Democratic Labour Party to keep the Catholic Church in power in Victoria and to keep Catholics supporting a party, which of course the archbishops had total control over. Of course, the trade unions in Australia have never had control over the Labour Party. The Catholic Church basically had control. Because you look at Turgot Whitlam, every Labour Prime Minister was a Catholic. And every Protestant Prime Minister was, of course, a liberal and country party.
Interesting. Very interesting.
I wish somebody would do that for us, because one of the Australians would do a leaflet on it, because I didn't know any of that.
Do you?
Expand upon the claim that we things to learn about the non-rational nature of politics and instant communication from something like the old life.
Well, this is what's important about reading the book, you know, when I read it the second time this year, and what I'd missed before. I tended to pass off all of the passages which weren't in somebody's mouth or weren't about the bush as being something I could skip. And certainly a lot of them are unrewarding, but a lot of them are rewarding. This is the point. And he's talking here, you get relationships with his wife and the discussions with his wife and so on, and what's going on inside this character, Summers. Why somebody who is really apolitical coming to politics, what is his apprehension of it? And he sees these people making their posturings and adopting their sort of political armour and so on. He feels repelled by it. And it's, I sort of sat back in the chair and I thought, you know, people who come fresh to a socialist meeting will get that sort of impression. And we don't do it on purpose. It's something that tends to cling to us almost as we become involved in the movement. And he didn't just... Well, he coated the left with that. The right, and this must have been a rather peculiar form of fascism he's pictured here. Kangaroo is... He touches it, as I said, to Ben Cooley's Jewishness. Why he does that, I don't know. And he does what a lot of people do, and that's say, I admire the Jewish culture, I admire their love of art, I admire their musical abilities and so on. But there is this, and I suppose he's thinking of the Jewish mama jokes, you know, there is this sort of all-embracing, sticky, lovey-dubbiness about them that wants to smother people. And this is what he foisted onto the fascist movement, the digger movement. And he also picked on the Australian mate business. He said, all this matiness, I can't stand. And I can't stand kangaroos wanting to hug me to his bosom, which he literally did in the story. You know, and he sort of wiped his hand on me, you know, after touching him in hospital, wiped his hand on the inside of his trousers after having touched him, because he didn't like this physical contact. And that's the sort of revulsion you've got there. So there's it's this sort of external thing. There's feelings about the politics, feelings about what they're up to, rather than going through their literal case. It comes out of the meeting, the first meeting, the quiet meeting, because it's two in the same day, and says, and it was all very logical. The working class case, the trade union case was all very logical. And that's damning at the faint prose, you see, because it ain't enough as far as she's concerned. That's not enough. And what I think he shows, rather than actually says, by the end of the book, is that a movement which is going to make real change has got to be bigger than this, in the sense of it's got to absorb more of people's enthusiasms, they've got to engage their emotions as well. This is why I drew parallels with the religious movements, and I've said it before on other occasions. Chairman Mao's Little Red Book was the latter-day equivalent of the Protestant access to the Bible. It was, you know, every man's individual conscience, and you've got to engage every man's individual allegiance. This is what they did here. Right? I think this sort of problem confronts us today. You will find many members of the working class who will not find an argument, not want to find an argument with most of the things that you say. That's the end of it. That's where it stops. And you think, well, why the hell don't you come in and do something about it? But we've not given them a reason to. In their light, in our, according to our lights, we have given them a reason. We've given them a pastime reason that if they don't do something, you know, they're going to be deeper in the proverbial than they were before, and the world's going to be a worse place. But that, for them, is not enough motivation. And I don't know what the motivation is, but I was suggesting, and I want people to discuss it, that what does seem to motivate people is the altruistic things. Even the poorest people will say, yeah, I'll put something in your box for you, mate. And we don't. We tend to say that's not the way to solve it. But, you know, when the Flag Days come out, or when Live Aid comes on the box, or when Burke, I've got his first name, Michael Burke, thank you, comes on television about Sub-Sahara, it shifts at least a nation. Now, they're mistaken. That ain't going to solve it. But there is a very important fact about there, that it moves them, and they will do something. Now, you might say, yeah, all they'll do is dig in for a bit of money. They wouldn't do anything else. I'm not so sure. I'm just putting it forward. We haven't got the solution yet. We haven't got the answer.
So just sort of going about the maziness, I mean, does it only occur in the Kangaroo, or does it occur in another novel? He came from a mining community, which I should imagine was very close to that maziness in that community. But the reason I asked, there was a programme, it's nothing to do with the H-R, it was a little while on television, about Australian men in this maziness.
I saw it myself. Actually. Yeah. I thought it was, and it wasn't too long before I started to read this. I was surprised at the case. Yeah, I think there is a part in Sons and Lovers, isn't there, where he rejects the ethos of the miners, you know, all this all sweating together and in the bath together business. He doesn't like it because he's brought up as an only child, you know, with a rather a finicky mother. Yes.
Yes.
I think there is a relationship in this and the discussion about individualism that was raised earlier. You see, I don't know that socialism and individualism is antithetical, as been sometimes suggested. In fact, I think the opposite. I think it's capitalism which is damaging to the idea of an individual. Well, we know that. It makes you have to become part of the class for a start. All of these other things we were talking before about women, we haven't dealt with the acknowledgement of issues of racism, and what was a racist, by standards anyway, what a racist did. But of course, race is itself a bogus category of belonging. And all these identities, some you're forced into, some you have this on your birth certificate, some are made by your relationship and means of production, they're the most important determining ones. In a sense, you don't choose to be in them at all. And assault your individuality. So if you do happen to have a taste for high art and the smell of incense, and your a wage slave, it's too bad. The most you can afford is affectation. She can't afford to, the real thing. So I think that there's another way of looking at it and saying, if you have a working class that is moving away from this traditional thing, which people on the left, and you must remember, two things about D.H. Lowell. One is, I think he was the last genuinely good romantic writer in the British tradition. Because he wrote in the 20th century, not the 19th century, because he wrote novels and not primarily poetry, although he did write poetry, a lot of people forget that. So Lawrence was a romantic. He was, you know, he was a romantic in the way that that Shelley or Wordsworth were romantic. And secondly, that unlike most of the other writers of his period, he was a working class person who rejected the matiness, the enforced community of the working class, whereas the others, the W.A. Jordans, the Stephen Spenders and so on, wanted to romanticise in their own minds and fantasise in their own minds about this idea of community, wonderful sort of community, not only of relationship, but a sort of physical community. We're all next to each other, we're all constantly talking to each other. Well, I think that they can afford to fantasise about it. If you look at the conditions in which poets and writers of that generation traditionally lived, they had plenty of space to themselves. So it was a sort of a luxury to come out of an Oxford college or a public school with huge ground or a big house surrounded by gardens and say, oh yes, we like the idea of community. It's so nice because, you know, community for them is a garden fete or going down to the local village once every couple of weeks to watch people trading pigs or whatever. But in reality, I mean, most of us know the experience of community is not some real community, it's not real society, it's enforced community, and it's pretty lousy. It's going to a school, it's working in an office, it's working in a factory, not many people doing that these days, working on a ship, all these things which are bloody horrible kinds of community. So I think individuality is a good thing. And I think that socialists should be saying, you know, we don't want a world where everyone's together all the time. We're not interested in communes. We're not interested in all the love and, you know, one human family all sitting around one table across the whole of the globe. I certainly am not interested in that. And as a matter of fact, it's quite interesting all these years afterwards, because I remember Peter Doherty mentioning individualism before, giving a lecture about alienation years ago at the Socialist Party office in Clapham. And I remember at the time getting up, you know, about 15, 16 years ago, and saying, I don't want to live in a society which is, not that he's proposing this thing, but I don't want to live in a society which is unalienated in the sense that we're all going to be friends together and smile and say, hello, neighbour, when you walk down the street and, you know, oh, I'm going to go and do my work quota now for the people. I think it's on a lot of lines. I don't want to, I'm not that interested in people, and I think most people, and I don't think either as socialists we should somehow feel apologetic about having some sympathy with D.H. Lawrence. I mean, D.H. Lawrence was a thoughtful person. He wasn't a genius, but we don't accept that sort of concept. Sorry, I don't accept that sort of concept. I suppose others here don't accept it either, that he was a born genius or he was a person with gifted powers, but I happen to think that he was a great writer or whatever else he was, a literary person. It takes a certain amount of training, a lot of thought, years of effort, skill, and maybe a bit of luck as well. And frankly, I don't object to the fact that we regarded a lot of people as insignificant and not worthy of his time and indeed worthy of his contempt. Why shouldn't we? Why shouldn't writers incidentally regard women who sit around in houses all day and have got nothing better to do than gossip and you know, talk about detergents or whatever? Why shouldn't they regard them as being insignificant and stupid? They are. So I don't have any objection personally to D.H. the idea that D.H. Wells, well, nor do I feel any embarrassment in identifying myself as someone who had a certain degree of contempt for the mass society in which we live, which after all was the great problem of the decade in which D.H. Wells died. He died in 1939, I believe. And I mean, after all, 1939 was the year in which mass society, as created by the Industrial Revolution, exploded in everyone's face. I mean, you had fascism, you had that monstrosity, Stalinism. You had people being pushed into bloody armies and forced to fight and wear uniforms in the name of freedom. You had all those horrible songs. You had the coming of radio, so everyone had to listen to this bloody propaganda coming into their homes. They couldn't walk down the street and decide which meeting to stop at and say, oh, here's a fascist speaker, I'll listen to him. Here's a Stalinist, or I'll listen to him. Instead, you have to listen to all this nonsense, Housewives, Choice, the Brains Trust, all this old music,
wine work,
of course. So I've got no objection whatsoever to somebody saying, look, we don't want mass society. Personally, I don't want to live in a mass society. I don't particularly care for a lot of people I meet. And because I'm a socialist, I don't feel any. I'm not a Christian. I'm not a moralist either. I'm not a Christian in particular. As far as I'm concerned, I don't take a view, love thy neighbour. I say, fuck a lot of them. A lot of them are a waste of time. They always will be. And some of them have reached an age where there's nothing you can do with them. You have got to bloody avoid them as far as you can. So if D.H. Lawrence is saying this kind of thing, good luck to him.
Thank you.
I think you've got some more people. Can I, at the moment, jump in and respond? Because I want to pick up a couple of points and keep them floating, if possible. I think one of the things he's doing, Lawrence is doing, is what Steve's suggesting there. He's attacking this sentimentalism about the working class, which is so prevalent on the left. And I think most members of this party, as opposed to virtually every other political party in the country and probably in the world apart from our companions, believes in a type of democracy which means that the individual damn well stands up and says, I don't agree with any of you. I can look around this room and see the faces of people who have done that repeatedly, who have stuck out as individuals and said, some what the lot of you say, you are wrong. Now, that is democratic individualism, and it seems to me to be the absolute essence of any real democracy at all. The sort of democracy which says to a hall of about 200 strong, oh, we all agreed then? Right, thank you. Now, that's what goes on in capitalism, and that's the sham democracy. Now, it seems to me that the historical process is that capitalism starts off with the ideal of individualism, and it means individualism only for the ruling class. And the point is that it has therefore introduced the ideal of individualism. And this is what the working class has got to take of capitalism and carry it forward for itself. And I think Lawrence has got that perfectly correct. I mean, I think it's quite... I've got the quote here about his attitude to socialism. All this theoretical socialism started by Jews like Marx and appealing only to the will to power in the masses, making money the whole crux. This has cruelly injured the working people of Europe. But the working people of Europe were generous by nature and money was not their primary passion. All this political socialism, all politics in fact, has conspired to make money the only god. And then he more or less drifts off onto his... religious things, and he's saying if you had all this, men would go mad. This sort of community thing, and that's what he's against. And he's poor the individual. This aristocratic thing which he does in here is really a division. I couldn't find that, and I haven't noted it. He splits human beings into two types: those who feel responsible about what's going on, and those who don't. And he says that they've got nothing in common with one another, and. The only people who really matter are the ones who feel responsible and concerned about what's going on. And that's his sort of aristocratic principle. How am I?
Yes.
I think the discussion is reaching a point of view difficulty. The difficulty, I think, is this. That I'm sure that some of us would like to move, say, in our propaganda, in our message, in our general appeal, towards a much greater appeal to individuality. I certainly would like to see things go that way. And I suppose if you wanted an example of one of the best expressions of this, it's in that old essay which predates Lawrence by quite a bit, doesn't it? By Oscar Wilde, The Soul Man Under Socialism. You may not like his example of Jesus Christ as the first individual, which comes later in the essay, but taking the essay as a whole, he's a brilliant little expression, an elegant expression of the importance of individuality and how the conditions of a socialist society will allow it to flower and develop. On the other hand, we are also bound to use all these great collective capitals. If you look at the Declaration of Principles, you know, a whole statement of the bloody great gigantic collective parts of happiness. And if you're going to understand society, how it operates, how it produces, who gets what, how, you can't possibly do it without using all those great class categories. So, you know, there's no way we can leave that, because we're jettisoning important analysis to try the scientific basis on which our political objective is to proceed. And yet at the same time, I'm certain that we ought to place a great deal more emphasis than we do on the importance of socialism insofar as it allows individuality that as against in running both the collective categories that we're also forcing into.
Couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the point is, however, and we've always made it, that unlike the left, we don't see any virtue in the working class as working class. We want the working class finished. This is the prime capital that you're talking about. So we have always been, though I don't think yet adequately, talking about wanting to get rid of ourselves as a category, wanting to get rid of the working class status and become individuals. Now, I think if we start forming ourselves a phraseology for this, and it won't be a very large step from what we've always said, I think it is there. But I think that we've got to disentangle ourselves from the leftist terminology. We've not bothered to do that enough. We've also got to watch it, particularly with the current times some of the things we're saying now, we've got to watch that we detach ourselves from the rightist mentality. Simply attacking politicians is not enough. Why do we attack politicians? What is it that politicians do to us? Is the thing. And they use us as so much garbage. That we are so many ticks on voting, crosses on voting slips for them. And that, I think, when we get a chance to say it, is the other thing. They're all for pushing us into the line. It's a question, I suppose, of having enough time to speak. This is what we were always forced into. Right, give us what you mean by socialism in 30 seconds, and then you're forced into talking in huge categories. I suppose what we're going to do is fight for space and time to expand what we've said. I mean, but we've always said, you're for socialism, I wouldn't be seeing dead with you otherwise. You know, we're dead individualistic like that, aren't we?
I would like to make an announcement for the 9th of February next week. This week, we have an educational meeting, Back to Basics, Fast or Fraud, by Adam Beek in Camden Branch. And yeah, okay.
What's really matter is the contact with John. I was going to say, I always saw socialism to do with community, not with individuals.
Anybody else on there?
Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, human beings, we're social property animals by our nature. It's capitalism that's you know, trying to reduce us to isolated and individual competing on the marketplace. So this, you know, this idea that the individual could exist separate from society and separate from fellow human beings, it's just a well, it's individualist anarchism. It's not socialism. Socialism, you know, our case against capitalism is that it forces us to be individuals and we can't be members of a cooperative community, I suppose.
Yes.
I think I'm not talking about different things. Individualism within capitalism is right. We are reinforcing individuals within capitalism, each for their own, each fighting for a little bit of something that of a great whole. But I think that a community, a proper true community, would recognise and respect the differences in us all, and as the speaker just said, allow space for that.
Yes. I agree with that, but nobody is advocating at all that individuals should exist outside of society. As a matter of fact, an individual couldn't exist outside of society. It's a nonsense. So, if the position of an old-fashioned socialist is to knock down straw men, well, it seems pretty pointless to do that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there is an association, which is often sometimes called old-fashioned socialism, of people sitting around, romanticising coal miners and coal mines, and men in showers and women in bloody washrooms, lawyers doing the laundry, and people going on coaches singing songs together, holidays in Margate where we're all there together and we're all happy. And of course everybody
would like it.
Well, let them have it. It'll be more space for those who don't. That's good because they can all stand together. They can all stand together and take up less room. I'm not against people who want to be all housed together. I don't even mind doing it myself occasionally. I can think of an occasion. I'd have to be drunk to do it. I can think of an occasion where I'd sit in a room full of people and sing or, you know, whatever. I certainly wouldn't do it sober like the nutcases in churches do, to walk into one of those places and, you know, and completely cold sober sit there singing together and feeling a sense of community. I think those people are mad. You know they are. But I don't think for one minute that the proposition anyway, we all know the proposition is not that individuals in the outside of society. Max Stirner wrote a book called The Ego and His Own, which was advocating that individualist anarchist position. And it's not actually a serious argument. It's not a conceivable argument that people could think like that. But I think that the more it is put as a problem, the more correct the nature of the problem appears. That for socialists to spend all our time talking in terms of this kind of wonderful life in which we're all going to be in it together, like some, you know, never-ending version of the Second World War, where we all go down to the tube station at night and sleep together in our sleeping bag because we worry that the other person's not there. And it smacks of deep insecurity to a start, you know, that you're so worried about whether anyone's going to notice you in the world. The only way you can do it is by having a revolution to organise a society where you're permanently bumping into people and you're having to work with them all the time. Oh, against all the modern technology liberating us from it. I mean, these days, capitalism is doing it. We don't need socialism for this bit. People are going to be working in the home. I mean, the factory is a thing of the past. Thank Christ for that. Who wants factories? The only people who have ever been in favour of factories are capitalists who made a great deal of money out of them, and poets and writers who sat on the outskirts of factories and said, factory is wonderful, and of course the old-fashioned socialists who never worked in a bloody factory in their lives. If they'd gone into a factory, they'd have bloody had a heart attack by lunchtime. So I'm not romanticising any of those things at all. I think it's a very, very important point. I'm very glad I came to hear this discussion being raised today now that I've formed in my mind. And I think that what Peter Arndt said is right. We want to apply all of these collective terms to capitalism.
you know, capitalism would make all this collectivity necessary. Going to bloody school, you know, because that's when it starts, they get you when you're a kid. Herding them all in together, all in groups, all in teams, all in houses, of course, earning points for your houses, losing points for your house. The hell with it all. The thing to do is right from the start, educate, tell your children, have nothing at all to do with any of these teams. If you're in a team, help maybe lose, just to get out of it. That's the approach that we should have. And all these things, borough, my borough is better than your one, village, garden, our garden display is better than the next village's garden display. Country, that's where nationalism is. Oh, our country, so that I hope we get into the World Cup. I've only ever been interested in an international football match in the hope that one country will lose. I have been concerned about certain countries losing. I do like to see England lose, and I do like to see certain other countries lose, because I particularly dislike them. But I've never liked any country, and I don't think any socialist could. I mean, old-fashioned socialists like Ayman, he liked countries, but then he wanted Britain to have an empire and a big navy. So I don't think that old-fashioned socialists had all the answers, funny enough, when it came to collectivism. Now, I think this is a good point. Apply all this to capitalism, chuck out all of this with capitalism, and actually, I think socialists could be on a winner with this particular argument, which is what we want to do is appeal to people and say, look, all the left want to give you is a lot of bloody collectivity, you know, so that a lot of bloody lonely people can create a society where they're going to all be in one big room together, one big happy family. Well, forget that. The Tories have lied to you because they told you they're going to give you individual freedom, and they don't. That's where the right is wrong. So what socialists are saying is, it can be. You can be on your own. You can be free. If you want to get on with other people, if you want to enter into relationships of this kind or that, beyond the one relationship we have to carry out socially, which is work, let's get on with the rest of it on our own and as socialists, we could make a very, very big impact with that argument. I intend, as soon as I go home tonight, to write an article with this effect and see if the old fashioned socialists of the editorial committee will write.
It's very significant to me, if I can comment, Chairman, that the acme of togetherness is the stamping down of the BNP, that's big football, and the type of crowd mentality there, even worse for the mentality of boxing matches and the crowd mentality there, I think it is absolutely deplorable, and I think that it's very much akin to the sort of training you get for bayonet practice, you know, except that the numbers are greater. Now, I think that all of this is relatively unsubtle. What we are talking about getting towards is a concept which is neither Robinson Crusoe nor is it the Nuremberg Rally. We are talking about an inevitability of a numerous society, but the possibility of individualism within it. And that seems to me to be what democracy is about. You've got demos there as the people, but you've also got the individual, each one with the power to have a say and a vote in what is being decided. And an ability to... When I wrote about what I imagined a socialist society might be like, one of the ideas that came into my head for living quarters was a capitalist institution, funnily enough, was a top-class hotel. A top-class hotel, or a very good Cambridge College, Oxford College, gives you the ability to look entirely on your own, sport the oak if you want to keep other people out, but also if you want it, there's the common room, there's the buttery, there's the TV room, there's squash courts and so on. Now that seems to me to have as one example, and there may be plenty of others, one example of the best of both worlds. You can be an individual there if you want to, and you can also be collective if you want to. But that concept of individualism within a collective society seems to be the sort of
individual. There's one thing I know I find these meetings, you talk about a future society, and a subject that's very much under debate today, is that it's the family, nuclear family.
Well, we do talk about it. I think it would take us off our current topic. I think it's an excellent discussion topic, and it's one I will talk with you for a couple of hours on when we've got plenty of time. It's quite fascinating, but I think it'll take us off today's topic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, is that corner?
Well, I think the contradiction in the surprise of individualism, and what you were saying before, if I understood it, one of the main points you were trying to make, that people have got to have some motivation beyond individual self-interest to become a socialist or to achieve a socialist society. I would suggest that what you're looking for is a sense of community. All these things that Steve was dismissing, like village diversity and the region of nationalism, these are false communities. So I would suggest that what human beings are looking for is to live in a community. But this gets distorted into things like nationalism and support for football clubs and so on. So, if you're thinking of something beyond mere individual self-interest, I suggest that's it. And also, I don't think that democracy would work unless there's a sense of community. You know, I don't regard the ideal person to make a democracy work is somebody that's going to get up all the time and say, I protest, you're wrong, I insist on my right. Democracy is not going to work unless the people that are in the minority are going to accept what the majority say. And they only accept what the majority say if they think there's a wider communal interest. So I think, in fact, all this praise of individualism goes against community is what we're out for.
You see, I don't think it's a case of either or. No, I think you're still making it either or.
It's not just me.
In what you've just said, I think it's making it either or. It seems to me to be the strength of any community, staunchness of the individuals. And if you look at sort of idealised, say, strong villages, you'll get the person who is recognised as the blacksmith, the person who is recognised as the witch with the herbs and so on, the person who is recognised as the midwife, the person who is recognised as the miller or whatever, whichever period you want to set it in. I didn't mind criticism on that. The point which is most important to me is the question of what we say to other people in the future. And Adam's picked this one up again. And he says, if we are expecting people to look for something outside themselves, more altruistic than self-interest, then surely community is the thing. And I don't think it is the only thing. I think that it is possible to talk to people as responsible members of the human race. Do you want to allow this to go on? How would you think that it ought to be organised? Not only what's the most logical way, but what appeals to you as a way to organise things? What would you want if you could do it? There is really, as we say, no longer any scientific or technological reason against doing most of these things. There are some logistical reasons. I like getting everybody on the Isle of Wight is theoretically possible, but practically extremely difficult. So I don't think it's community in the sense of the togetherness. It's this all army. You'd be the first if people started putting their arms around your shoulder. And this is the sort of thing which Lawrence is fending off. And I'm saying I think he's right in this. I think it's phony. Most people, it is when it crops up in rugby clubs and so on, disturbed sexuality, it seems to me. It's going down a particular road which I don't think is particularly healthy.
Thank the Lord I'm not.
Yes, well, I'm not making that sort of comment because that's less tolerant. I mean, I think that the rugby club embodies the idea of the boxing crowd and the sexual perversion all in one. You know, I'm not very happy with the idea.
The biggest phoniness to me is when you get Remembrance Sunday at the Albert Hall, and when they all sing, they all hold their heads down, and everybody knows it's phony.
Yeah.
Of togetherness which we find distasteful. The first 10 years of my life were spent in a couple of hundred yards to pop the Hotspur football ground. And that inoculated me for life against 50,000 people shouting in favour or against anything. But in the last 25 years, that was the first 10 years, the last 25 years, I've been pleasurably involved in activity. Initially, it was my children involved. Now they've gone their different ways. I'm still actively involved in a music centre where everybody involved, all the children involved, it's the children, are in some kind of orchestra when they're 5 and 6, in little groups of percussion instruments, still there in orchestras playing violins and cellos and so on. Now, there are analogies with rugby clubs and football clubs and so on, which I find repugnant, but I find this togetherness in producing the sound of whatever it is, enormously satisfying. And I find the participants achieve together what they couldn't possibly achieve separately. So there are examples which indicate, not at the same time for the unpleasant ones instance so far.
I think it's a very important point, yes. I mean, I think it's, that's dimensions of the thing. Yeah, I thoroughly agree. And I think the key word is in producing. It's for doing something, as opposed to being a spectator.
Yeah.
I think we have come to the end of the meeting. If anyone, having said that, welcome to wind up. Or,
I don't think there's anyone in the pub to do. Yeah.